welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. We are once again going back 100 years to the time of the First World War, between the times of April 1915 and May 1915. We'll be starting this installment with some excerpts from the family paper Happy Days, a paper for young and old. From the paper printed April 24th, 1915, we'll be hearing part of a story called At the Firing Line, and we'll be hearing an advertisement for the Joker's cigar.
Chapter 9, The Attack on the Fleet. The submarine boat was underwater, and the pallid radiance of the electric searchlight shone into the little cabin. The next thing Dick knew, there was a big fish looking in through the deadlight at him. Where were they bound? What was coming next? All kinds of startling thoughts came into Dick's mind, but all was soon made clear by the engineer, who said, "Now, Mr. Dalton, the beginning of the greatest war this world has ever seen is about to take place. It is the desire of Vice Admiral Brown that you should be allowed to witness the opening attack, but not against your own wish. It is for you to decide." "Seeing that I am here, I should like very much to do so," replied Dick. "Very well," was the reply. "In a few moments we shall rise alongside a torpedo boat, the commander of which is Captain King, who for the time being has relinquished his command to manage the Bird. He is a graduate of the Annapolis Naval Academy, and is well known to me," cried Dick. "He spent 6 months working with me at Cramps." "The Admiral is aware of that," was the reply, "hence his desire to afford you this opportunity. We are now rising. I will see that you are sent on board the Bird. Follow me to the deck." Dick arose and left the cabin with the engineer, for the submarine had now come to the surface. Close beside them lay a torpedo boat of the first class, her decks crowded with men. Signals were exchanged, a boat launched from the Bird, and Dick, in company with two officers, went aboard the torpedo boat, where he was immediately greeted by Captain King, who extended as warm a welcome as could possibly have been desired. After a few preliminary inquiries regarding his father and his own situation, Captain King informed Dick that his was to be the honor of occupying a position on the Bird with him during the run into Cuxhaven, which was then to be made. The other torpedo boat had not departed, mingling with the battleships of the British fleet, of which Dick counted 14, and within 20 minutes the start for that remarkable night attack was made. "This way, Dick Dalton," said Captain King, as Dick followed his new guide. "Step through the door here, stoop and raise your feet. Now turn and look at the door through which we have passed. The door must needs be strong, for the treasure it has to keep behind it is the honor of our flag. Now climb again. Here we have more space. Now, at last, we are in the conning tower." Dick looked around him with intense interest. All that he saw cannot be described here, but Captain King seemed to feel it necessary to go into some explanation of details, many of which Dick already knew. "You will perceive, Dick," the captain said, "that our space here is scarcely 6 feet across. Touch the wall in front of you. It is thin steel, carried down, as you know, far into the framework of the boat. This is the fighting position, but one less well posted than yourself would naturally ask how an action can be directed from a spot where no enemy is visible. Stand here and bring your eye to the level of the wall, and mark the narrow slit between the arched cupola above us and the steel walls of the chamber. Sweep your eye around, and the whole horizon will come within your view. Look down, and in front of you is the sharp bow of the boat and the torpedo tube. Now look inside of the fittings of our conning tower. These characters on the brass tablets which surround you mean bow torpedo tube, above water torpedo tube, etc. On the left, there is a voice tube to the engine room, and that key which my finger points to completes the circuit which discharges the Whitehead torpedoes. Here in the center is the steam steering wheel, binnacle, and compass. As you see, we have everything all as trim and shipshape as on an American man of war." Such was the place in which Dick Dalton now found himself. And although he had been on many a torpedo boat before, to find himself on one during an action was a novelty indeed, and that promised to be his good fortune before much time had passed. During the next hour, Dick remained a passive spectator, exchanging a few words with Captain King now and then. In a very short time, the fleet got under way, the big warships standing in toward the port, taking up a position at the mouth of the harbor just out of reach of the guns of the fort. After a brief delay, Dick saw the beginnings of that famous attack. The British torpedo boats, 8 in number, went shooting toward the German fleet, their presence unsuspected. They went swiftly and silently. "Watch now, watch and listen," cried Captain King in great excitement. "The war is about to begin." "Are they all asleep there in the fort?" cried Dick, amazed at the boldness of the movement. "We know our business. Most of them are at a ball. "Watch, Dick Dalton, and you will see." Suddenly, in the distance, a loud explosion broke upon the stillness, echoing and re-echoing. This was instantly followed by others. Dick counted 6, and the searchlights of the enemy began to illuminate the scene. The exact position of each German ship in the bay was known, and each torpedo boat had gone to attack a different warship. 2 ships were badly listed when struck, and the greatest excitement was manifest among the German man-of-warsmen who swarmed their decks. 2 of the torpedo fleet were now in full retreat. They had done their deadly work and were shooting over the sunken mines out of the harbor as rapidly as they had entered. They only drew 5 feet of water, and the explosive mines were 9 feet below the surface. "They've knocked 2 of the Germans out, and there will be others," cried Captain King. "Ha! They have waked up in the fort at last." The heavy boom of a gun followed a flash of fire. At the same instant, Dick perceived that the Kaiser had got on the move in company with 2 other ships whose names Dick did not know. Captain King now started to get the Bird in position to attack the Kaiser, and Dick was told to leave the conning tower, as his presence was likely to interfere with the captain's work. Reaching the deck, Dick saw that the Kaiser was heading directly for them as the Bird rushed toward her. Suddenly, a tongue of flame shot forth from her forward barbette, and a thick, eddying bank of white smoke rolled and tumbled over her bows, driven forward by the blast of a great gun. There was a scream from the shell, and then some 20 yards away there rose in the air a vast column of water, and Dick's eyes, following the direction of the shot in the glare of a searchlight, marked the great jets which sprang up from the water as the shot ricocheted over the surface. Now the guns of the Goeben began to boom from the fort side, which was toward the Bird. At the same instant, Dick was seized by an officer. "You are wanted," he cried. "The torpedo sticks. We cannot discharge it. Come." Dick flew to obey. It was the bow tube. The difficulty with the gear was at once apparent to Dick, and with a wrench, he loosened a nut which remedied it. The spirit of the occasion had now seized him. "Try it," he cried. Captain King discharged the torpedo with great skill. Dick watched the Whitehead leave the tube and glide away. A few minutes after it was fired, a tremendous explosion followed on the German warship. The torpedo had done its deadly work. Dick stood on deck near one of the guns, and there came a thunderous roar from one of the 12-inch weapons on the Goeben. An enormous shell came tearing through the air straight at the little torpedo boat. For an instant, it seemed as if the Bird would be sunk. But fortunately, the boat sat low in the water, and as the missile was aimed a trifle too high, it passed over her deck, and so close to Dick that he felt the rush of air from it. The shell sunk in the sea. Around curved the torpedo boat, and away she dashed at a speed of nearly 30 knots an hour. As she sped away in full retreat, the Germans opened on her with their rapid-fire guns, some of the shots from which took effect in the thin steel plates of which she was built. Luckily, however, none of the shots pierced her below the waterline, and she continued on until she reached the harbor entrance. As she was passing out, some of the sunken mines were discharged from the forts on shore by electricity, but again her good luck stood by her, and she escaped unhurt. In a short time, she was safe with the rest of the British fleet, beyond range of the shore batteries and the guns on the warships in the harbor, and the English men-of-war were reached. Dick was now put aboard of the battleship Cloud with Captain Brown, and the decks were cleared for action to fight off any of the German fleet that might pursue the torpedo boats. All the torpedo fleet now huddled around the big battleships. At this juncture, a big German cruiser came out of the harbor. Searchlights were now in full play, and all was as bright as if it had happened in full sunlight. The cruiser soon drew quite close upon the Cloud, while other ships of the German fleet which had ventured out behind her began firing. The Cloud, bristling with guns, went boldly to meet the cruiser. Shots were exchanged between the 2 warships, and the German was hit, and as her engines were disabled, she began to drift. The British now ceased firing at the vessel, for they were soon close together. For some reason, the cruiser's stern swung around, making it evident that she must touch the Cloud. Dick hurried astern, for he saw that cutlasses were being rapidly dealt out by a junior officer. There seemed no doubt that an attempt was to be made to board the cruiser. This was the time that Dick forgot his neutrality, although in his subsequent dealings with Ned Ralston, he kept this incident to himself. He had to protect his life, for he knew that if the British were whipped, he would perish for being with them. Seizing a cutlass, he jumped in with them, and as the cruiser's stern touched the Cloud, Dick, with some 20 others, scrambled aboard. It was a mad attack, and from what Dick learned later, it was directed by a subordinate officer on the Cloud, who was severely taken to task for the affair. But of this, Dick then knew nothing, and cared less, until the British fell upon the German sailors with a fury which can scarcely be conceived, which made him regret his rashness in joining them. The Germans fell back for the moment, thrown off their balance by the fury of the attack of these daring boarders, and then returned valiantly to the charge. Heavens, this is keeping neutral with a vengeance, thought Dick, striking down a German who made a spring at him with drawn cutlass. But it was a fight for life now, and Dick jumped into the thick of it with the rest. Loud cries from the cloud added to the confusion. Whistles sounded sharply. The cruiser had now sheered off. The Germans, massing their forces, drove the handful of British back, and those who were not struck down went tumbling over the rail like sheep. It was at this moment, while Dick was working back to the rail himself, that he saw three British seamen set upon a young German officer with their cutlasses, who had fallen to the deck. It was too much for Dick Dalton. "They shan't kill that young fellow," he thought, springing in front of the officer. To be continued.
The Joker's Cigar. The biggest sell of the season, a real cigar made of tobacco, but secreted in the center of the cigar, about 1/2 inch from the end, is a fountain of sparklets. The moment the fire reaches this fountain, hundreds of sparks of fire burst forth in every direction, to the astonishment of the smoker. The fire is stage fire and will not burn the skin or clothing. After the fireworks, the victim can continue smoking the cigar to the end. Price 10 cents. 3 for 25 cents. 1 dozen 90 cents. Mailed postpaid. Wolf Novelty Company. New York. New York.
Up next from Saturday, May 8th, 1915, we have an article from the Ardmore Chronicle titled Big Parade, Stimulus to Women's Suffrage.
Big Parade, Stimulus to Woman's Suffrage. City newspapers laud marchers and predict victory at polls. Mainline marchers. Philadelphia, May 5. The Great Suffrage Parade, held here last Saturday, has increased interest in the cause more than 100%. Quick to take advantage of it, the women are following Dr. Anna Howard Shaw's advice and are working harder than ever to win votes. Mrs. George Pearsall, chairman of the Philadelphia Woman Suffrage Party, voiced the sentiment of the suffragists of the city when she said, "We do not intend to lose any of the effect of the parade by wasting time talking about it. We are going to harness the tremendous tide of favorable sentiment which it created and use it to help us to victory in November." The suffragists are justified in resting content upon the newspaper accounts of the parade. All of the papers characterized it as the biggest and most convincing demonstration in favor of suffrage in the history of the city. Some of the comments were, Philadelphia Inquirer, "On to victory" was the slogan of their march, and under that banner, the votes for women advocates rallied to their ranks an army of equal suffrage friends and supporters never numerically equaled or even approached in any previous demonstrations for that cause in Philadelphia. As the fair seekers after franchise passed by, some on horses, others in automobiles, but many more than either of these stalking bravely along on foot, they were the recipients of applause, which, measured by its heartiness and frequency, seemed to augur well for November and imbued the equal suffragists with a new vim and an even greater confidence and courage. Evening Ledger, editorial. The Evening Ledger extends its heartiest congratulations to the women of Philadelphia and surrounding territory. The demonstration given by them this afternoon was magnificent. It won thousands of votes for the cause. It was admirably carried out. Brilliancy of color added to the beauty of the parade, but there was more to it than brilliancy or beauty. It answered conclusively the argument that women do not want the vote. It was an augury of success in November. Congratulations! North American, the parade was the most potent, voiceless speech that the suffragists have ever delivered. It presented arguments from the old and the young, the married and the single, the women of leisure, the professional woman, and the working woman. It demonstrated the democracy of the suffrage movement. Philadelphia Press. One could hear nearly everywhere congratulatory comments on the parade. That is where Dr. Anna Howard Shaw read aright the faces of the sidewalk crowds. She couldn't have had a chance to talk to anyone, except those who paraded during the time she marched, but she certainly read in the faces as she passed the kindly way they felt. Three of the biggest moving picture companies in the country had cameramen at various points along the line of march. The pictures will be shown all over the country. A large number of mainline suffragists took part in the parade.
Our next clip is from Happy Days, this time from May 8, 1915, an article titled Interesting Items.
Interesting Items. A frigate bird can fly an entire week without stopping to rest. The wolves of Russia devour about 200 children and travelers every year. Where the soil has permitted, wells have been bored to a depth of 60 feet with a new hand-operated posthole digger. In Paris, there is a baker's oven, which is heated by electricity. The temperature can be readily regulated, and the oven is a great success. In the National Museum at Washington is a sapphire weighing 9 carats that encloses a bubble which changes of temperature cause to appear and disappear. Sealskin shoes for dogs are made in Labrador. The dogs attached to sledges travel at great speed over the rough ice, and some protection for the feet is necessary. Trees, whose roots are of the same length and fiber, do not thrive as well as those which are unequal. They develop better when their roots reach for nutriment in different strata or depths of the earth. A marvelous flower grows on the isthmus of Tehuantepec. Its chief peculiarity is the habit of changing its color during the day. In the morning, it is white. When the sun is at its zenith, it is red. And at night, it is blue. The organ of one of the churches in Belfast, Ireland, has refused to work. Investigation has revealed the presence of a large eel in the exhaust pipe. It was, of course, dead, and there is no explanation as to how it got there. Thimbles were first known as thumbbells, from their shape and the place where they were worn. The finger was soon found to be a more convenient place, and with the loss of their position, the name was modified to thimble. Japan has greatly advanced during recent years in the art of toy making. The Japanese are now manufacturing yearly about $5 million worth of toys, of which 40% are for exportation. They are at present trying to capture a much larger share of the world's toy trade, believing that they can get much of the business formerly done by the Germans. Osaka stands first as a toy making center, followed by Tokyo.
Up next from the Gaelic American, printed May 8, 1915, we have an interesting article titled Leaves from a Traveler's Notebook, An American's Impression on the War in Europe.
Leaves from a Traveler's Notebook. Impressions of an American visitor during a journey to Europe soon after the outbreak of the war. The various countries throughout which I had passed, being either actually at war or else fully mobilized, I had an opportunity of observing the soldiers of each and of comparing them as an ordinary observer, leaving out of question the matters of training and efficiency, and basing an inexpert opinion on superficial observations alone, I would give the German first place. His physique, his apparent stamina, his setup, his confidence in himself and in the ability of his country to take care of itself, and in the unquestioned loyalty he shows and expresses to his country and his Kaiser. Next to him, I would place the Swiss, equal to him in some of the qualities mentioned, particularly national spirit, and closely approaching him in others. In the same rank with the Swiss, or else very close to them, I would place the Hollanders. They're anything but what Washington Irving, in his biased writings, describes the New Amsterdam Dutch to have been. Instead of the heavy, ponderous, slow-moving, phlegmatic Dutchman of Irving, They were alert, lithe, and well set up, like the Swiss. I saw no Belgian soldiers, except some prisoners who, of course, seemed depressed. I did not see many Austrian soldiers, and I do not know to which of the various races of the dual empire those that I saw may have belonged. I saw many thousands of French captives. They did not, of course, appear to advantage under the circumstances, but as compared with the wounded German soldiers, who also appeared under unfavorable conditions, they seemed inferior in physique. The French were all clad in the familiar blue tunic and red trousers. The Germans had a smart, serviceable, well-fitting uniform of gray, with a faint greenish or bluish tint peeping through. They were all well-shod, unlike the French. The British captives, whom I saw in Germany, made a favorable impression. Perhaps they were Scotch or Irish, because I must say that all of those I noticed in London were light, frail boys, and their appearance recalled to my mind what I had read about the same kind of youths in the Boer War. They were undersized and looked as if they had been engaged in sedentary occupations.
Up next, some sad news from the Star and Herald, printed Sunday, May 9th, 1915, called Death's Toll of the Lusitania, 1,346. This is printed 2 days after the actual sinking of the RMS Lusitania, May 7th, 1915. This article may be the first that some readers learn of the disaster.
Death's Toll of the Lusitania, 1,346. Details of the Lusitania's end. Was struck by 2 torpedoes at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Consensus of opinion is that the vessel went down in 10 minutes. Very few of the first-class passengers appear to have been saved. London, May 8th. According to estimates made by the Admiralty, the loss on the Lusitania amounts to 1,502, including 60 North Americans. The United States Consul at Queenstown reports that only 51 American citizens are reported saved, among which are not reported Alfred Vanderbilt and other well-known financiers and businessmen. All statements of the survivors agree that the Lusitania was torpedoed without warning at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when the majority of the passengers were at lunch in the dining room. Some of the survivors say that the ship sunk in 15 minutes, while others say it sunk in 30 minutes. Officials say that the work of compiling the figures of the lost and saved is progressing slowly, but the indications are that the first-class passengers were mostly saved, very few perishing. It is also said that a large number of the crew was saved, and that Captain Turner sank with the ship, but that after 3 hours he was picked up. All the boats but one engaged in the work of rescuing the survivors have returned. Therefore, there is little hope that any additional survivors will be picked up. 595 survivors were landed at Queenstown, 11 at Kinsale. 52 are reported still on board an unknown steamship. 45 corpses of persons who died by drowning or from wounds received have been landed at Queenstown, and 5 at Kinsale. It is reported that the steam trawler Heron has picked up 100 corpses. The latest dispatches from Queenstown announce that additional bodies are arriving on every incoming boat. The Cunard warehouse is being used as a morgue and is now filled to its utmost capacity, thereby making it necessary that bodies be taken to the town hall, hotels, and private residences.
For May 19th, 1915, we have a small mood booster from the weekly publication The Fatherland, an advertisement for a new type of coffee set to sweep the nation.
Kaffeehag. Caffeine-freed coffee. Not a substitute. Get a package of Kaffeehag today. Make it just as you do ordinary coffee. Taste it and relish its snappy flavor. Besides tasting mighty good, there's no biliousness, headache, or nervousness in Kaffeehag. The only coffee that will not injure the health and that can be enjoyed in any desired quantity at any time. All of the delights, none of the regrets. 25 cents the package, in the bean only. All dealers. Kaffeehag Corporation, 225 Fifth Avenue, New York.
1 week after the sinking of the Lusitania, we find this opinion piece on the front page of the Gaelic American. From May 15th, 1915, a piece titled, The Lusitania Was a Floating Arsenal.
The Lusitania was a floating arsenal. The following article was written for the Illinois Staatszeitung of Chicago by request, New York, May 9, 1915. I deplore the loss of life in the sinking of the Lusitania, whether the vessel was sunk by German torpedoes or a British mine. I particularly deplore the loss of American lives, for the sake of the victims and their families, and because of the bad effect their death will have on the German cause in America. But the responsibility for the loss of life must be placed on the English government and the Cunard Steamship Company, which put non-combatants and women and children on board an auxiliary cruiser of the British Navy, which was undoubtedly armed, notwithstanding the British denial, which was loaded with munitions of war, including high explosives, and had among her passengers many British reservists on their way to the seat of war. The vessel was literally a floating arsenal and was as legitimate prey for the enemies of England as a transport carrying troops or a train laden with ammunition and supplies on the way to the front. From the moment she sailed, the Lusitania was under orders of the British Admiralty as completely as the rest of the English fleet, and the placing of noncombatants on board was in effect and purpose the same as putting prisoners or civilians as a screen in front of an advancing column of troops. The effect of the sinking of the Lusitania will, of course, be twofold. One will concern British prestige and England's mastery of the sea. The other will affect the German cause in America and the lavishly subsidized British-American propaganda. On the first, the effect will be injurious to an incalculable degree. On the second, it will undoubtedly be bad.
Up next, from May 19, 1915, we have another piece from the Fatherland. This piece is titled, Why the Lusitania Was Sunk.
Why the Lusitania Was Sunk. Last week, we predicted the fate that has overtaken the Lusitania. The Fatherland did not reach the newsstands till Saturday, but the editorial in question was written several days before publication. Today, we make another prediction. Every large passenger ship bound for England is practically a swimming arsenal, carrying vast quantities of ammunition and explosives of every description. An arsenal, whether on sea or land, is not a safe place for women and children. It is not a safe place for anyone. Every now and then, we read of a warship blown up by an explosion caused by spontaneous combustion, in spite of the rigid care exercised to prevent such an accident. Our passenger ships carry more explosives than the ordinary man of war. No innocent passenger should be allowed to embark on a vessel carrying explosives. It stands to reason that a fate not unlike that of the Lusitania will meet before long a passenger ship by an explosion of vast stores of ammunition within. While Germany is not bound to respect a flag of any ship carrying implements of murder, German submarines may discriminate in favor of a neutral flag. Spontaneous combustion recognizes no international convention. Much as we regret the staggering loss of life and the disaster that startled the world, the facts in the case absolutely justify the action of the Germans. Legally and morally, there is no basis for any protest on the part of the United States. The Lusitania was a British ship. British ships have been instructed by the Admiralty to ram submarines and to take active measures against the enemy. Hence, every British ship must be considered in the light of a warship.
Next on our program, we have a more personal item from the Catholic Standard Times, May 15, 1915, about one of the victims of the Lusitania disaster, Father Maturin.
Father Maturin, a Lusitania victim. Distinguished convert priest among those who perished when great liner was torpedoed. Among the passengers on the ill-fated Cunard liner Lusitania, which was torpedoed and sunk by a submarine off Kinsale Head, Ireland on Friday, May 7th, was the Reverend Basil William Maturin of Holywell, Oxford, England, formerly rector of St. Clement's Protestant Episcopal Church, Philadelphia. Father Maturin's name did not appear in the list of survivors, and on Wednesday, the fears of his many friends in this city that he was one of the more than 1,000 who perished were confirmed by the news of the recovery and identification of his body. The grief with which the many friends of Father Maturin in this city learned of his death was accentuated by the fact that just prior to his sailing he spent several days here as the guest of Mrs. Caldwell Ravinus. On Sunday, April 25th, he preached in St. Patrick's Church. Overcome evil with good was his text, and in his profoundly impressive discourse, he evinced all the power that 20 years ago won for him fame as one of the greatest of English pulpit orators. Father Matrin was an Irishman born in Dublin in 1847. Father Matrin graduated at Trinity College Dublin and, leaving Ireland, became curate at Peterstow, England. 3 years later, in 1873, he went to Cooley St. John. When a branch of the order was founded in this country, under the name of the Society of Mission Priests of St. John the Evangelist, with headquarters in Boston, Father Matrin was sent to America.
Up next from the Gaelic American, we have our final advertisement of the episode. This one's titled, Good Clothes Are Half the Battle, from May 15th, 1915.
Good clothes are half the battle. The well-dressed man has tremendous advantage over the other fellow, and it is easy for you to choose the right kind of clothes. Let me make you a suit to your exact measurements of one of the beautiful materials I have on hand. There's an astounding difference between tailor-made and ready-made clothes. The man who knows sees this very quickly. Tailor-mades have the finished look that goes with all export work, and success comes to the man who looks prosperous. Patrick J. Hoey, leading Irish tailor, 941 6th Avenue, New York, between 53rd and 54th Streets. Telephone COL1789.
The last audio clip we have for you in this episode of Mail Call is a narrative of the last voyage of the Lusitania, as told through the letters and memoir of one of the survivors, Charles E. Lauriat, Jr.
Naturally, I saw the notice issued by the Imperial German Embassy, published in all of the New York papers of May 1st. On the opposite page, I reprint the whole notice issued by the Embassy in order to correct the erroneous impression I find held by many people, that the Lusitania was specified in it.
Notice: travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies, and Great Britain and her allies, that the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles, that, in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or any of her allies are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travelers sailing in the war zone on ships of Great Britain or her allies do so at their own risk. Imperial German Embassy, Washington, D.C., April 22nd, 1915.
It is a coincidence that this notice appeared in some of the New York papers beside the advertisement of the proposed sailings of the Cunard Line. Like many other passengers, I gave the notice no serious thought. No idea of canceling my trip occurred to me. I did not sail with a feeling of defiance towards the embassy, either for the notice or for any action that might follow. But I admit that I did not think any human being with a drop of red blood in his veins, called a man, could issue an order to sink a passenger steamer without at least giving the women and children a chance to get away. True, it was a ship of a belligerent nation and carried citizens of countries with which Germany was at war, but I could not believe their policy of frightfulness would be carried to such an extent as events afterwards proved. The steamer did have in her cargo some ammunition, but taking all things into consideration, I did not believe an order would be given to torpedo this boat without warning, and without an opportunity being given to passengers to take to the boats, and so possibly cause one of the greatest marine disasters of modern times. The order is now a proven fact in history.
That concludes this episode of Mail Call, a podcast of news stories and bulletins from the Great War. This episode featured the voice talents of Laura Bang, Allison Dobier, Michael Foyt, Marjorie Haynes, Damian Katz, Susan Riley Stevens, David Uspel, Alexander Williams, Sarah Wingo, and myself, Chris Halbert. The producers of Mail Call are Ramon McBride and Chris Halbert. Executive producer, Laura Bang. Our theme music is from Till We Meet Again, as performed by the Nicholas Orlando Orchestra. This week's outro is When the Lusitania Went Down by Herbert Stewart and his orchestra. You can find this clip on archive.org. This episode featured historical documents from April 1915 to May 1915, accessed from the digital collections of the Digital Library of Villanova University and the Library of Congress. For more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org.
Crossing the sea, American ships that sail from our slip are safer for you and me. A Yankee can go anywhere as long as all glory is there. Although they were warned, the warning they scorned, and now we must try in despair. Some of us lost the truth we had, some of us lost the dear dad, some lost them all, our sisters and brothers, some lost the best friends they had. This time they were stopping this war affair with women and children.